and it looks to you like everything is inert. And now with your insulated tongue, you put it all back together, and you suddenly realize you've got voltage again across the capacitor, somewhat like what was there when you charged it. It turns out that the stored energy that everyone thinks is excess electrons on one plate and a lack of electrons on the other plate, that's not where, in most capacitors, the real energy is being stored. The real energy is being stored, in my example, in the plastic, in the way you've disturbed the individual molecules of the plastic itself, the orbits of those electrons, which I think is the major way it's stored. I don't think it's being stored in polarization of the protons in the nucleus, but there I'm not absolutely positive. But so, in the material itself, you're storing energy, and that's where the extra capacitance is coming from. In the case of an electrolytic capacitor, there's a very fancy juice, so to speak, that's inside of the capacitor, which dries out after a period of time. That's why the capacitors go down in microfarads, and you have to replace them after a certain number of years. But you're storing the energy in that fluid that's inside. So dielectric material doesn't have to be a solid. It could be a fluid. Water as a dielectric material has a dielectric constant of 81. You take purified distilled water and you put it in between the plates of your capacitor, however number of picofarads or microfarads you had before. Add the water and the microfarads of that capacitor just went up by an 80-to-1 ratio. Ain't that crazy? In the case of water, each individual water molecule is a dipole, and that gives it some very funny characteristics. One of the articles you can see, let me drop, on YouTube that I saw recently is what happens if you take a chunk of solid dry ice, so-called solid CO2, and you put it in the microwave oven. What happens? The answer is nothing. The microwave oven doesn't respond to the solid chunk of CO2, just like it doesn't respond to a chunk of ice, per se. In both cases, the molecules are locked in a matrix when they're in a solid, and they're not free to move. But in the case of carbon dioxide happens to be a non-polar molecule. It is oxygen, carbon, oxygen, where the two oxygens are 180 degrees apart in that molecule. In the case of water, H2O, the two hydrogen molecules are only 111 degrees apart against that oxygen molecule, and that becomes a polarized molecule. Water in the fluid form is a polarized molecule. It's a dipole, and when you put water in your microwave oven, each individual water molecule is flipping back and forth on each half cycle of the 2 gigahertz signal of that microwave oven. And that's the mechanism by which energy is put into that water. That's the mechanism by which it has a whole lot of dielectric constant. That's the mechanism by which it has heating. Because the water molecules are moving very rapidly and bouncing in between each other. And because it is a dumbbell-shaped, dipole-like molecule flipping back and forth, on each bounce that those molecules come together, the dumbbells hit each other while they're rotating, and therefore, after the bounce, they've got greater energy on average than they had before the bounce. That's the mechanism by which the water gets heated in your microwave oven. I wonder if this is some of the information you were looking for, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. Well, the thing is that there is such an inconsistency with your conclusion that you've given to us. And the reason for that is that if you have a medium is used to store the energy, then energy could not be stored in the top of the vacuum. There are two plates of the capacitor, and you don't have a medium. So that's the inconsistency. Another thing that is worth to be mentioned is capacitors work based on the electrostatic principle. Electrostatic principles do not have a delta T. there is no darkness. There is a static immediate. You have a two balls of this plasma, and the plasma is jumping. Before the plasma is formed, because of the difference of the potential between two contacts of this plasma, you have a first free electron. When the first free electron is created, the cosmic ray is bombarding the first electron, and the electron will then accelerate it. Now there is a bunch of free electrons that is created. And now, each one of these electrons that is thrown out of the atom is making the atom more positive with less electrons. Now this electron is looking for another atom that has more, that has a perfect structure. Let me stop for a moment. Okay, now, ions, that means the atoms must always in pair with the electron, the free electron. So you have a pair of it. Now, when the spark of plasma is created, the spark, the plasma acts as a white, or as a coil, because it's a conductive medium, a dark has just like the capacitor, dark has its own responsibility. But one of the factors associated with it is delta T. Now, if you happen to a plate, two plates of the capacitor right beneath the spark in vertical fashion, so they directly heating the plasma or between the balls of the plasma, you are able to to catch the signal at its maximum on the right hand side of the spark and deliver that one to the one plate of the capacitor by switching at that time, you have the electrostatic effect, that is immediate, has no delta T. And because of the rules of the physics, the magnetic field that is created is 90 degrees to the electric field. Electric field between the plate of the capacitor is horizontal. The magnetic field between the plate of the capacitor is vertical. Let me draw. Okay, now, because the capacitor works on the electrostatic principle, the time is not involved in the air, and then the presence of the electromagnetic field is immediate, is faster than delta T of the spark. So, basically, I see the contradiction between the medium keeping the energy. Of course, it could help to keep the energy by spreading the energy, but if you're dealing with the total vacuum, you have no medium and no source of the energy. But you do have a magnetic field between the plate of the capacitor that is directed towards the spark. That is the plate of the capacitor are right directly beneath the spark. Now you're dealing with the acceleration of heavy particles, which is an atom in form of an ion. Now you're speeding up the particles between the spark up. And to say, this is the theory of Dr. Vladimir Yudkin.
Send KC2QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, I'm going to address some of what Wes just said, but I'm going to go to Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in with one small comment. The one thing, Wesley, is that you mentioned that you can't store energy in a vacuum. And that's absolutely positively not true. You definitely can store energy in a vacuum. As a matter of fact, another word for the dielectric constant is also permittivity. And as a matter of fact, between two plates, you know, it's static, nothing moving, no delta T. If you wanted to know how much permittivity or dielectric constant there is of a vacuum, it's actually somewhere around 8.8 farads per meter. And you can definitely store energy in a vacuum. Now certainly as you increase the material atomic count in between, the permittivity can go from that only up. But certainly you can definitely store energy. As a matter of fact, that is the, you know, there is a dielectric constant for a vacuum. Over to you, K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Glenn, you're right with the number, 8.854 farads per meter times 10 to the minus 12. So it's 8.85.
Thank you, Dick, for the correction. Times 10 to the minus 12, that's correct.
So it's 8.85 picofarads per meter is the dielectric constant of vacuum. And now, Glenn just said that he believes you can store energy in that vacuum. I agree with that. But I've got another example that makes that one clear that comes from my experience. The hottest vacuum in the universe, with rare exception, is that space in between Earth and Moon. When those astronauts traveled from the Earth toward the Moon, they were going through an extremely hard vacuum. Very few molecules of anything was there, except for a little bit of solar wind. And as long as they're lucky enough to choose the time of their trip, when the sun is not giving them a great big CME, coronal mass ejection, as long as there isn't a whole lot of material flying out of the sun, then there is an extremely hard vacuum in between Earth and Moon. I personally sat on the Earth with my homebrew 12-foot parabolic dish in Florida, aimed at the Moon while the Apollo 15 and later on the Apollo 16 astronauts were there. They transmitted their 10-watt signal at 2287.5 megacycles, and that radio signal went through that hard vacuum between Earth and Moon, and some of that energy arrived at my antenna. I listened to it, and out of the loudspeaker came astronaut audio. Now, Irwin and I can't remember the three astronauts, that was Apollo 15. Mattingly, Young, and Duke, yeah, that was Apollo 16, and Irwin, somebody will have to tell me who the three astronauts were on Apollo 15. Anyhow, through that hard vacuum, energy was transferred. Because the dielectric constant of vacuum is this real number, 8.85 picofarads per meter, even though nothing is there, it stores energy. So everything has a dielectric constant. And so when we talk about the Hermit
repeater, timeout, cancel.
When we talk about the permittivity of something, we're talking about, with reference to vacuum, we use vacuum as the reference. That 8.85 picofarads per meter is the reference, and now your additional material, which usually has more mass than a vacuum, is something, with rare exception, that is a positive number above that. In the case of FR4 board, it has almost four times as many picofarads per meter as hard vacuum, and because it's four times higher, we say it has a relative dielectric constant of four. And so in that plastic, yes, you're storing this excessive energy, but energy does get stored in that vacuum. And now you've got a conflict, of course. How in the world can you store energy in something that by definition is nothing, usually by definition of nothing? The vacuum, we think, is nothing. And yet that radio wave goes through that nothing, and energy gets transferred. In the case of Moon to Earth, what I experienced, in the case of many of the other space probes, energy gets sent over billions of miles. And so nothing can convey energy. That's the magic of radio. And at the molecular level, how it does it is not super clear. Over to you. By the way, when you get an electrostatic breakdown in air, where you're getting an avalanching of electrons that you've yanked off of the individual molecules because of a very strong voltage per volts per meter local E field, and that avalanching effect is or is not related to dielectric constant, that's now possibly a different subject. Over to you, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
B2BHY with a comment.
Jim recognized, but Wes first. And try to keep it a little bit brief, Wes.
I understand that. Okay, first, there is a certain contradiction in here. And the reason for that is that where the person, the usual law, body put in motion, stay in motion. If you have the string of the energy, let's say in form of the particle, whatever the particle, it's a body. when you put a object into the space and put in motion, stay in motion. But the body has its own capacity, it acts on whatever it is. If the energy were to be stored in total vacuum, then you would have the interaction between the properties or electrical properties of that body in the total vacuum. We have a photon. Photon is a clean energy that doesn't have a mass based on the traditional physics. So that energy comes from the sun through the vacuum as an energy and it hits the first molecule of air in the ionosphere and creates the aurora. But there is no proof for the fact that vacuum can store energy. Vacuum can send energy. The electromagnetic wave that you have created is the movement of the energy. When it hits the space where there is a total vacuum, then you're dealing with the neutron flow. Whatever is left over is going to travel with the speed based on what's put in motion and stay in motion. I don't see the proving here of energy being stored. I would like you to describe to me how the energy is being stored in the vacuum. Also, the electrostatic mist has no delta T. It's immediate creation of the magnetic field at 90 degrees to the electrical field that is horizontal between two vertical plates of the capacitor is immediate with no delta T and two X-rays.
Okay, 2QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, we're going to pick up Jim West, I mean Jim Glenn, and I've got a comment on that one, but Jim first. I'll go right ahead, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW.
Thanks, Rick. Yeah, I'd asked a question like this in my science class when we were learning about sound, and I had said that if sound cannot travel through space because there is nothing to vibrate, isn't radio a higher frequency version of sound? And theoretically, shouldn't sound not be able to travel through space? And I told my science teacher that I had thought about it, and sound, the reason sound cannot travel through space is because there is absence. There is, I don't want to say nothing because as you said before, there are particles in space, but it is a vacuum. There is nothing. The radio is different from sound, isn't it? Radio does not vibrate molecules, and that's the real reason that sound cannot travel through space. Radio is an electromagnetic transfer, so it is not a physical vibration of the air, but it is transferred magnets work in space. Or hopefully they do, at least I think they do. Therefore, radio waves work in space. Well, I mean electricity, and again, as you said before, you can transfer electricity in space.
KC2QIQ with a comment on that one.
Yeah, all of these radio waves and electromagnetic waves, transverse electromagnetic waves, TEM, that really means that the voltage is in one plane, the magnetic field is in the other plane, and both of those phenomena are at right angles to the propagation. That's why it's called transverse electromagnetic waves. So as I go from very, very low radio frequencies all the way up through the higher radio frequencies, the infrared, optical, ultraviolet, soft X-rays, hard X-rays, cosmic rays, as I go through the electromagnetic frequency spectrum, those are all transverse waves. A sound wave is a longitudinal wave. A sound wave, the particles are moving back and forth in the direction of propagation. If I had my slinky run from the north end of my living room to the south end of my living room, and I want to propagate a sound wave through that slinky, in theory I'm pushing my hand cyclically north and south, and I'm getting this compression wave moving down the slinky. That's what a sound wave looks like. If I wave my hand left and right, or if I wave my hand up and down, that's a transverse wave traveling down the slinky, and that's a little bit more similar to an electromagnetic wave. So the electromagnetic wave is at right angles. The sound wave is longitudinal, along. Well, sound waves do require particles to be moved. The magic of electromagnetic is there need not be any particles in the hard vacuum of space. By some magic, it's not completely clear to me, that electromagnetic wave, transverse electromagnetic wave, moves through that hard vacuum of space, and it's happy to do that. And Glenn's going to make that clear to us. It says here, KC2QIQ, I'm having some fun with you, Glenn. K2RIW, I'm a tech man. This is a tough one.
Yeah, it is. These are fun topics, and I think what's happening here, too, is that when you were probably posing the question to your teacher, what may not have been discussed was that when we talk about audio frequencies or sound waves, we're always talking about, as Dick was explaining, that the sound of our voice, typically in a room when you're talking to someone, is moving through a fluid. It's called air. So when you're speaking, you're vibrating the air, and the air is moving at a certain speed, and then your ear gets vibrated, and you actually hear the sound. Now, if you move into a vacuum, that fluid is missing. So the sound wave in the audible area where your ear would normally hear it won't be available. But let's say if you were to use the low frequencies, like a few hundred hertz, regular audio frequency, and you had a huge antenna and an electromagnetic generator that you could actually generate a wave at that very, very low frequency, that will travel through a vacuum at that very, very low frequency. And if you had an antenna on the other end of the universe somewhere, it could pick up that signal. So you can actually send a low frequency wave in an electromagnetic vacuum, and it will transfer. It's just that the voice that you hear wouldn't transfer unless you have a fluid or some kind of air that would transfer the sound to your ear. But the frequency isn't really the problem. It's really just a matter of how you generate it. If you were to generate that low frequency into a super huge antenna, you could still transmit a very, very low frequency electromagnetic wave. K2RIW, KC2, right there.
I'm now for a minute going to go...
Yeah. So my question, too.
I was trying to say I'm now going to go back to Wesley's question. And that is, I'm going to give Wesley a second example of the energy that's stored in a vacuum. The first example I gave is my own personal experience of hearing those Apollo astronauts of Apollo 15 and 16 on the moon, a quarter of a million miles away, a quarter of a million miles of hard vacuum between that moon and that Earth, down in Farmingdale where I had this antenna. And that radio wave went through that vacuum and got to the energy that they transmitted. A millionth of a billionth of a watt is what I received when they were transmitting 10 watts. I received a millionth of a billionth of a watt out of my 12-foot dish, and with the proper receiver set up, out came astronaut audio. Here's a second example of my own personal experience. I can take two metal plates that are, let me pick a number, 3 inches apart. Two metal plates, maybe each metal plate is 6 inches square, and they're 3 inches apart. And I charge them up with my electrostatic Wimters generator, and I charge them up to 15 kilovolts. I have done that. And I've got this electrostatic voltmeter that I've got in between the two plates. This is a great big machine, which is about a foot and a half cube. It's got a great big Dawson valve movement on the front. And inside, it's got a probe. It's got this great big chunk of glass, which looks like a high voltage insulator coming out the back. You connect one lead of the voltage you want to measure to that high voltage probe. You connect the other lead to the chassis. And inside, as you put voltage on that probe, inside it creates electrostatic attraction to a moving vane mechanism inside that moves the needle on the front panel. And how far that needle moves tells you how many volts you got. So here's the experiment I did. Let me drop. And the magic of that voltmeter is it draws no current. It is a voltmeter with an input impedance that's very close to infinity. It's probably way beyond 100 gig ohms of resistance, and maybe beyond that. Probably some number of tera ohms of resistance, just the amount of fingerprint that I didn't clean off on that 1 foot long or a half foot long glass high voltage insulator out the back. That's the only real loading that meter creates. The meter creates no loading. So I got the meter adjusted, connected with clip leads across my two metal plates. The two metal plates are, let's say, 3 inches apart, and I charge them to 15 kilovolts by turning the wheel on my Windhurst generator. I stop turning the wheel, and I sit there and watch it, and the 15 kilovolts very slowly drains off to 14, 13, 12, and so on. But if I do the experiment fast enough, so that the amount of drain, the slow discharging of those two plates, is such that I've got the plates 3 inches apart, I'm measuring the voltage, it starts off at 15 kilovolts, I rapidly separate the two plates from 3 inches to 6 inches. I double the distance between the plates. The voltage on the voltmeter doubles. The 15 kilovolts that was there, maybe it's down to 14 kilovolts now, it jumps up to 28 kilovolts. I have more voltage on those plates because I have done nothing but separate them. Now, when I double the voltage on the plates, you're about to ask, where's the conservation of energy here? And I'm going to explain that one to you. The amount of energy on a capacitor is 1/2 CV squared. Because I doubled the distance between the plates, I know that I now have half the capacitance in picofarads that I had before. I'm down to half the capacitance. But the voltage doubled. If I take double the voltage, and since the energy is 1/2 CV squared, I get 4 times as much component because I've doubled the voltage. I get half as much component because I've halved the capacitance. The net result is that my new larger spacing capacitor has twice the energy it had before. I've doubled the energy on the capacitor. I've doubled the voltage on the capacitor by simply separating the plates and did nothing else. At first it sounds like magic. It sounds like it's a perpetual motion. It's not. First of all, you're about to ask where did the energy came from. I supplied it with my muscles. It turns out that when you put high voltage on two plates, there is a calculatable Lorentz force, an electrostatic force between the two plates. They're trying to suck themselves together. One plate is positively charged, the other plate is negatively charged. Oppositely charged objects attract each other, and there's a force between the two. When I separated those two plates from 3 inches to 6 inches, in theory, I did work. My muscles supplied the energy to increase the separation between those two plates, even though they're trying to suck each other together. So the double of the energy on the plates, where did it come from? I supplied it. But now, the real energy in that vacuum, in between those two plates, it happens to be the air that's in my room. But I know darn well if I did this experiment by remote control inside of a vacuum bell jar, I would get the same answer. Let me drop. Now, by ordinary circumstances, if somebody asked me, when there's positive voltage on one plate and negative voltage on the other plate, what does that mean? Ordinarily, I would say, I've got a certain number of electrons on the negative plate, I have a certain number of lack of electrons on the positive plate, and the difference between the two, I call that 15,000 volts. And now when I separated the plates by doubling the distance, and I now measure 30,000 volts, or 28,000 volts, almost doubled, so to speak, did I put more electrons in there? I think the answer is no. I think it's the exact same number of electrons. I didn't drain away any because my circuit is an open circuit. My voltmeter is an open circuit. It's drawing no current. And if I do it fast enough so that the air isn't slowly discharging it, the humidity in my air is slowly discharging these plates. But if I do the experiment fast enough, I get twice the voltage. The exact same number of electrons, I believe, are still on those plates. But because they are now separated through a larger distance, the calculated energy in that system is a greater number. I've got twice the number of joules in that capacitor when I doubled the distance. All I did was to double the distance of the quasi-vacuum. It happens to be air. But I could do it in a bell jar, and I know I would get the same as Zanta. So the vacuum that, in theory, could be between those two plates, when I increase the magnitude of that vacuum by doubling the distance, I've doubled the energy. That's a second example of what appears to be saying the vacuum, which consists of nothing, has energy, has a calculatable amount of energy, it's got permittivity, it has a well-documented amount of permittivity, 8.85 picofarads per meter, picofarads, period, 8.85 pic...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It is picofarads per meter. So it's got a calculated amount of dielectric permittivity, got a calculated amount of energy, and by doing this experiment, I can change the amount of energy by changing the amount of vacuum that's in between my two plates. I know this is not, at the molecular level, this is a hard one to explain. I'm going to go, and maybe Wes has got an explanation for this. I've seen it, I've done it, I've read the explanations, I accept the explanation that I've read. But I don't have a warm, fuzzy feeling here. I know that something else is going on. I'm still, like everyone else, I'm having trouble believing that nothing can store energy. But that vacuum is doing it. Over to you, Wes. K2RIW.
C2QIQ with a comment?
Yeah, Wes first and then Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Wes.
Well, the thing is that the theory of the Big Bang is a comfortable way of explaining things that happen. It just fits with logic. Nobody knows that it happened for sure, but it fits with logic. You happened to be, let's say, imagine for a moment that you and Ben, you are two magicians. You show me the end of the result and you say, see, it's happening, I have it, I've seen it. What you're missing to explain is how is that being stored. So far there is no proof. I'm not saying that energy could not be stored in a vacuum. There is no proof of the fact that energy is being stored in a total vacuum. But there is a proof of the fact that body could in motion set in motion. That body should have an interaction of its own capacity and inductance or the resistance. Because the vacuum is the energy reservoir, because then there is all of the physics violated in terms of the conservation energy. If energy is interacting with the energy, because then we have the transfer of the energy. So because the Newton's law is so far the fundament of the physics in this particular situation, which you think is hard to be accepted and to exist.
Yeah, I don't claim to have anywhere near all the answers in this case. Glenn, you probably read those kind of experiments where you increase the spacing of the two plates of a capacitor, which in theory could be in a vacuum, and the apparent voltage, the measurable voltage on the two plates will double. And I used to think voltage was some number of electrons. Well, that's not really what it is. I know that that experiment did not add electrons to the negative plate, and I'm pretty sure it did not subtract electrons from the positive plate. And yet the voltage between the two doubled. That means that the volts per meter stayed the same. There's a clue. The volts per meter between the two plates stayed the same. Is that the method by which a vacuum stores energy? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
These are interesting problems, because when you look at the equations for this, the thing to always keep in mind is that energy is one entity and mass is another entity. And most of the time what we're always doing is we're always trying to look at things like electron count and other areas like that to measure the energy, because we want to see, in other words, the way that we detect energy is we look at its reaction on a mass. So in other words, we see some effect on a mass, and then we think, oh, okay, some energy was transferred or work was done, and then we can calculate the amount of overall energy available. But what's interesting to take note of is that energy is a separate entity. It does not require mass. In other words, we see its effect on mass because it's just the way that we sense and perceive things. But you can definitely displace energy over very, very large distances of vacuum, and it certainly can be stored, it can be transferred. As a matter of fact, when you add mass into your vacuum, generally what happens is it creates a delaying effect. In other words, when you add a higher dielectric constant inside your vacuum, you create a delay. It slows it down, and it will change its phase. You'll have a change in phase shift. So the fastest energy that you can transfer through space is going to be in a vacuum. So how do we detect it on the other end? And I think this is where always the confusion comes in, is that you need some kind of mass on the other side to measure it. But certainly energy is a unit onto its own without mass. K2RIW, K22, QI2.
Let me respond to that.
There is mass to that energy, though, Glenn. Photo energy does have a so-called light pressure. It's a very, very small number. But there is a real pressure to those light waves, to the portion of the light waves that are flowing out of the...
I've got the answer for that one.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Light, when it travels in a pure vacuum, in other words, if light is in a complete vacuum and it's moving as an electromagnetic wave at that frequency, just like when sound waves move through a pure vacuum in electromagnetic energy, you can't hear it or detect it with your ear. Just like when light is traveling through space, if there's no mass in the way anywhere, that electromagnetic wave goes right through it and there's no visible light. It's not until you get a particle in the way or a piece of paper or something in there that gets in the way of that electromagnetic wave for the wave to contact the mass, and then we can calculate with a quantum equation and start looking at and quantize the mass and that electromagnetic wave passing through it, and then we can give it a photon number, and then we can count the amount of electron wave and photons in upon that mass and come up with an energy. But when it's in a, but if light is just traveling as an electromagnetic wave through space, it's dark. There's absolutely nothing until you actually put some kind of mass in the way. You can do this experiment with a flashlight. Hold a flashlight just up in the sky with there's no clouds or anything at night time, and you'll see it almost looks invisible. But there's something in the way of it, and all of a sudden it illuminates. And then you can calculate the energy on that mass. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Hey, Glenn, when NASA is setting up these solar sails, and they get real thrust out of the solar sail, if photons have no mass, and we think they have no mass, where does the force come from on a solar sail? Over to you, Glenn.
From the electromagnetic wave. Now, keep in mind, the solar sail is a mass. The electromagnetic wave strikes the solar sail, and upon that, there again, now it becomes quantized again. And you can quantize in photons, the amount of electromagnetic wave being interreacted on that mass, and now you have an energy and a pressure created because the electromagnetic wave is intersecting the mass. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Those photons that are hitting that solar sail.
They're not hitting the solar sail. The electromagnetic wave is hitting the sail. The photon is an energy unit associated to the mass of the sail. The electromagnetic wave hits the sail, and then you can quantize in a photon. So in other words, there's no photon moving through space. The photon is only occurring at the time where the electromagnetic wave strikes the mass.
Okay. You think the photon has no mass? You think the photon has no mass, it has no energy, until this massless, energyless thing strikes something, and suddenly the mass and the energy appears? Seems to be what you're saying, Glenn. Go ahead.
That's interreaction. Let me let it drop for a second. That's the key interreaction point. In other words, the photon is a quantized unit of energy measurement. In other words, we need some way to do a measurement and a calculation on a mass at a molecular level. But when the electromagnetic wave is moving through space, there's pure vacuum. There's no mass to account for, just electromagnetic wave, or what's referred to as dark light. In other words, there's electromagnetic wave moving through deep space with no mass in the way. But until it actually strikes some kind of mass, now you can create a photon at that interreaction at that striking point where the electromagnetic wave is hitting the mass, and we can calculate an energy level at that point. But if the electromagnetic wave is just displayed in space, it's just a displacement and a vector in three dimensions. But if it's not striking any mass, what energy is there? What photon is there? There's no photon. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
I'm going to hit you with a really funny question, Glenn. And it's not going to be an easy one to answer. And don't feel bad. I was reading, no, I was watching a NOVA program, one of these programs on PBS a few days ago. And they were talking about the way the sun works. The sun is, for the last 4.5 billion years, converting helium into hydrogen into helium by a fusion process in the center of the sun. So it is fusing hydrogen molecules into helium molecules, gets a tremendous amount of energy out of it. It is converting mass into energy. And by all we know, it's following Einstein's beautiful equation, E equals mc squared. The energy in joules equals mass in kilograms times the speed of light in meters per second squared. You follow that, a very simple looking equation, and that's where the mass is being converted to energy by that equation. And the program said, the program specifically said that the sun is converting 4 million tons of hydrogen into helium. It is losing a mass at the rate of 4 million tons per second. 4 million tons per second of mass at the sun is being converted to energy. I said, gee, that's interesting. And I did two very interesting experiments that to me were an eye-opener. Let me just drop for a second and tell you about it. It's reasonably well documented that the sun is giving us an amount of energy, power flux density, 1340 roughly watts per square meter. At our distance, the sunshine on the Earth is hitting the Earth everywhere with 1340 watts per square meter. I know the exact distance per se between sun and Earth, 93 million miles. Therefore, I could make believe the sun is in the middle of a spherical room where the room has a radius of 93 million miles. I can easily calculate the area of that spherical room. And I know that all the energy coming out of the sun, 1,340 watts per square meter, over that number of square meters, 4 pi r squared, where r is 93 million miles, you work out that mathematics, and you calculate the amount of energy coming out of the sun right now. And the answer is 3 times 10 to the 26 watts. The sun is a transmitter of 3 times 10 to the 26 watts. You take 3 times 10 to the 26 watts as an amount of energy. You see it, you use it on that equation, E equals mc squared. You know the mass of the material, 4 million tons per second. And what do you come out with? That exact amount of energy. In other words, the rate at which the sun is converting mass into energy that it is transmitting as sunlight, per se, it's a great big spectrum, but you know what I mean, and the rate at which that sunlight is hitting the Earth works out as a beautiful calculation. Now, the fact that it worked out that way, does that mean they really measured the amount of rate at which the sun is losing mass, or did they use Einstein's equation and I'm just reconfirming it? Let me drop for a second. And the next thing I did with that was to worry about, okay, if the sun is losing mass at the rate of 4 million tons per second, how long is it going to take to run out? The sun has a mass of 10 to the 30 kilograms. And you go through the mathematics of that, and you end up with 10 to the 13 years. We only need 5 billion years, and we got 10 to the 13 years. So 13 power years. So if it was going to use up all that energy, no sweat. Also, the solar wind is believed to be using, throwing out mass from the sun at the exact same rate. Very close to 4 million tons per second is the rate at which real particles are being thrown out of the sun as solar wind on average. Sometimes it's great big CMEs, but on average 4 million tons per second of both solar wind and mass consumption. Now, when NASA sets up a solar sail and we get a certain amount of solar pressure to propel that vehicle with the solar sail, if I went and calculated 4 million tons per second of mass conversion at the center of the sun, and I spread it out over that great big spherical surface, 93 million miles in radius, and I figure out the amount of it that is hitting my little solar sail, I'm kind of curious as to whether or not I would come up with the exact same amount of force, if you know what I mean. What's your guess on that one, Glenn? KCQQIQ? And after that, we'll pick up the person who wants to break in. K2RW in second. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, I think what's happening is they're using Einstein's equation, and what they're doing is you're looking at intensity, at a point measurement. But in other words, it's not the calculated total energy output from, in other words, all the way around the sun, if you know what I'm saying, in other words, encompassing all area. So in other words, I think if you were to look at the intensity and in one vector line, I think that's what they're doing. And yes, on the solar cell, that would be the same calculation that K2RIW, K2QIQ.
Now, wait a minute here, Glenn. I did use the whole area. I assume the sun is an isotropic radiator. I'm assuming it radiates as much sunlight north and south as it does east and west and all the way around that sphere. 4 pi r squared is the area of that sphere. I know what the area of the Earth is. I can figure out the total amount of energy that the Earth is getting from the sun. By the way, the total energy mankind is using today on planet Earth and the total amount of energy the sun is giving you at 93 million miles is a very interesting ratio, 10,000 to 1. In other words, the amount of energy that all of mankind is consuming in all of the things we do is 1/10,000 the amount of energy that the total Earth is getting from the sun. That implies we better start going over to renewable energy sources pretty soon, because as we use fossil fuels, it is my guess that every day we're burning up 1,000 years of past history. We're not going to get away with that forever. I really wish that in order to put more people to work, the current administration was using more work projects administration type things. I wish we were building more solar cells, more wind farms and whatever. We could and be building more bridges and fixing more roads. There's a hell of a lot of things we could be putting our population to work doing that would make us more energy independent, and it would also simultaneously solve the CO2 global warming situation, which, yes, is controversial. And yes, Obama did put some money into a solar company, and the solar company went bust. The fact that one company failed, does that mean we should become gun-shy and never fund any more solar companies? Come on. Are we going to allow that to make us, to scare us away from funding projects, whether they be shovel-ready or not? We could be putting a lot of people to work by building renewable energy resources. We'd be making a fantastic investment in the future. There must be people out there with some strong opinions on this one. Who is it that wanted to sign in? He's made...
Yes.
Somebody has made 3 attempts. Who was that? K2RIW?
Okay, do you have one comment to that?
This person has tried now for 2 or 3 minutes. Who was that?
Ricky.
Go ahead, Ricky.
Wesley.
There was another person trying to break in. Who was that? Okay, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I know that when it comes to energy, it's a very, very hot topic. It's something that, you know, I've worked in pretty much my whole career, power, energy, and, power and energy are very, very difficult things to, anybody who's ever tried to generate power, whether you do it with a gasoline generator or by any other means, you realize pretty quickly that you can get over your head real quick trying to make power. And I know that this thing has become so political in every other way, but I think the renewable energies are on the right track, but there's some things that have to take place first. Let me let it drop. Right now, the amount of university study and funding, I know MIT has been doing some phenomenal experiments, I know, even with the solar voltaic, other things that they're doing, but it's still a way, way off deck. I mean, it's going to take a long time. We need the funding for renewable energies really has to be thrown at the universities. We need our best brain power in the universities working on this one. It's not ready for hardware yet. Just the sheer numbers of efficiencies and what we would actually have to do, it's going to take a while before, right now, just trying to force a technology that's not mature yet, I think is a big mistake. And in the meantime, we have natural resources here in the United States that we can use, and it's just a matter of using them smart. And if we give ourselves another 50 years with, say, something like natural gas, which would get us over the hurdle, and we wouldn't even need to use Middle Eastern oil or anything like that, just by using our own resources, and then put all the rest of the funding into basically university stuff, then in maybe 25 to 50 years from now, we'll have the real deal. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
N2XJN.
N2XJN. Start off with your name, sir, and your comment.
Thank you, Glenn. Wesley. You both of you gentlemen are still missing two things that I asked you for. One thing is how the energy is being stored in the vacuum. The second question is the statement sorry, that the energy could be stored in the vacuum, then the energy could be extracted from the vacuum. Now we say that the reservoir of the energy in the vacuum is huge. Now we have a solution for all of the energy problems. So will you please concentrate for a moment, not on the political issues, but simple and the answer how the energy is being stored in the vacuum.
I've got some evidence, not proof, but by that capacitance experiment and the astronauts transmitting and the sun putting energy through the vacuum of space and hits the Earth. By the way, let me go back to Glenn's last statement, and that is, Glenn, you said yes that the solar cells we got right now, maybe they're running 10% efficient, and that makes us feel uncomfortable. How about wind power? Are you unhappy with the efficiency of wind generators? And what should stop us? We got tremendous amounts of Midwestern land where we can put up wind generators in the middle of farm fields, and it doesn't stop the farmer from farming and the dairy farmers from dairying, if you know what I mean. Are you unhappy with the efficiency of wind generators? And I'm not saying that this is going to be an immediate solution to our energy independence problem, but the longest journey begins with the first step. We can simultaneously, I mean, if we're able to put hundreds of billions of dollars into making sure that certain businesses don't fail. Yes, it was a loan. We could take a very small fraction of that and put it into businesses that are putting people to work generating renewable energy. You're unhappy with the efficiency of solar, and I understand that. Are you also unhappy with the efficiency of wind generators? They look to me like that's been boiled down to a very nice science. Over to you on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
The wind is just another area here again that's just in its infancy. We're just starting now. I mean, they've already been building windmills and putting them all over the place haphazardly, and the yield that's come from them has been so-so. I mean, yes, it fills some electrical needs, and the problem is where the wind generators are being located for distribution. The amount of money that went in to put them up compared to what you're actually getting out of them, I think they raise your electric bill more than lower them. And there's all kinds of things, crazy studies. But what is interesting is that more recently, MIT's been doing studies of where the wind is localized. And this is where I'm talking about university study again. In other words, before you start wasting all this money and throwing up all this hardware haphazardly, the university study showed the mapping of winds and the wind locations and came up with the best places where you could possibly put these wind generators. Let me let this drop for a second. And guess what? When we look at where all of our hardware is located, it's not in the areas where all the wind is. Just another example of, stepping out with hardware and spending money. And meanwhile, but if they had done the university study first and found out where the wind was, and then put the windmills in those locations, and then came up with a good distribution location to hook up into the grid, we would have been far better off. But all that money it was misspent. It's a shame, Dick. That's what I'm saying. We need more study here first. Figure out the real scientific answers, and then let the politicians argue about it later. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I think the wind generators that have put up so far, the really big ones, are doing a very good job, Lynn. You're saying they could be a little bit more efficient. Sometimes, if they were put in a better location. Sometimes good enough is good enough. It doesn't have to be perfect. And as you install those, you can perfect the process and put more of them in the future in the better locations. Yes, on this
PBS program, they did show you a worldwide map of where the wind is flowing. And some of those places are where windmills are done, and some of them are not. But Midwest has a lot of wind. People have for generations in Oklahoma made a joke that if I could sell the wind, I'd be a millionaire. Well, now they're selling the wind, and it is working. And they're getting paybacks of numbers like a decade. And by the way, the people in Germany were willing to invest their own money to be more energy independent. They know that putting up those solar cells would increase the price of their electricity. They put that as a vote before the community, and the community said, yes, go for it. I will pay for that. I want energy independence. I don't want to be dependent on foreign oil that sometimes becomes pretty persnickety, and I can't depend on it. So would you and I be willing to make an investment? Would we be willing to increase our taxes some small amount to guarantee that we're more wind independent? I suspect that if it was properly presented, a certain percentage of this population would say, yes, go for it. Maybe you don't agree with that one, Glenn. Doesn't have to be perfect. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
If you get Paul.
Yeah, if we wait for perfect, we'll never do it, Paul. Over to you, Paul. I mean, here we go. Glenn, and then we're going to go to Paul right after that. Go ahead, Glenn.
Here again, this is a topic I really don't want to argue with you on, Dick. It's just, as I said, I think right now what's happening is there's just so much politics involved in this. It's something that is pretty well understood, and we know we don't need to base our energy on foreign sources. That we have it here. We have enough natural gas here. We have enough shale. We have a lot of things we can do here. If we only do it the right way first, and then let the politicians argue about it later. And in the meantime, put the other things, the more green things, into university study. We'll come up with a real solution, then be able to slowly work off and then put in the right hardware, and it'll be seamless. It won't cost us a lot of extra money. The fuel costs won't go up. It'd probably go down. K2IW, this is KC2QIQ, to go over to Paul.
Comment, Dick.
Hey, go ahead, Glenn, and then we're going to pick up with Paul. Hope we can put him to sleep. He's a retired guy. Go ahead, John. And then we're going to talk to you. Talk about your beautiful directional coupler, which is very repairable. You got it, John.
Dick, I think what Glenn is trying to point out, in short, is if we have tidal generation, are we going to put them in ponds? Or are we going to put them where the tide changes? I think you brought up an excellent point. And I don't understand why they didn't do that. But it's just another... I think they should investigate it. But if the science-minded people are telling them where the wind is, why aren't they doing it? Difficult question to answer. Over to you, Dick.
If I wanted to be a critic, I can always find that every one of the windmills that we've installed was installed in a good location, but not the absolute best location. I could, if I'm pessimistic enough, I could make that argument on every single one of them. It doesn't have to be perfect. When I was working in California at Edwards Air Force Base, I looked at the Tehachapi wind farm near the Mojave Desert, a very windy area of California. And that thing has been operating since the early 1990s, and it's going very successfully today. In the Midwest, there's a whole lot of very windy places in Oklahoma and Colorado and North Dakota and South Dakota and Missouri. And there's a lot of wind farms there, and they're working very well. It may not be the absolute best place. Yeah, the absolute best place, you got a problem. If I choose the absolute windiest place, it may not have a local grid that makes easy distribution of the power possible. And maybe we've got to increase the infrastructure of the grid. But without a doubt, natural gas is a beautiful fuel. It's a lot cleaner than oil and coal. It still puts carbon in the atmosphere, though, and it's still a finite source, and you still have to do some fracking in order to get it out of the ground, and that's a little bit controversial because in some cases it does. The fracking process does, in some cases, contaminate the water supply, and it does use carcinogenic chemicals. And are we properly controlling the chemistry that's used for the fracking? So to get the gas is not a slam dunk. To use the oil that we've got, even on Anwar, is not a slam dunk. And the wind is a little bit of a problem. To find the ideal location that is windy enough and close enough to a grid, it's not ideal. Doesn't have to be perfect. And you can either decide to study it for the next 20 years or you can stop doing something. We've got to be more energy independent. To take 50 or 60%